CMU podcast in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Baboom, Mega Upload, SFX and The Voice. I'm Andy Malt, I'm editor of CMU. In Edinburgh still is Chris Cook, business editor of CMU. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
And Chris, for this week, one week only, I'm going to let you talk about your show. How did your show go last week?
Oh, yeah, Chris Cook's Free Speech. It went very well, thank you. So I've done 3 performances. There are 2 performances still to go. As you hear this podcast, one of them will probably be just about to begin. But if you happen to be in Edinburgh, come along Friday or Saturday, 2 p.m. at Surgeon's Hall and hear me speak. It all went very well.
Well, good. And you're doing a free show as well. Did people put money in your bucket on the way out?
They did. We decided we're raising money for Index on Censorship. So I don't know whether that was... So therefore, quite a lot of money got put in the bucket. But I don't know whether that was because of my free speech was great or because they thought, oh, well, that's a good cause and I'll put some money. So it's hard to know, isn't it? We should have surveyed people as they were going out. Did you put that money in the box because you just had a really good 50 minutes of informative, entertaining speech? Or are you just sort of feeling guilty that you should be supporting that charity? But yeah, so it's going well. So if you are in Edinburgh, come along and join in the fun.
And speaking of putting money in the bucket on the way out, thank you again to everyone who has rated, reviewed and shared this show. It's very nice. Lots of people are doing it now.
Have they been putting money in the bucket on the way out?
Well, I mean, it was figurative money in the bucket.
I'd rather have real money in the bucket.
Well, they can do that too. If people want to email for our bank details, then that's fine. Speaking of putting money in the bucket, to use exactly the same segue, Baboom has launched. Baboom being the direct-to-fan service set up by Kim.com, the music industry's friend, which aimed to give 90% of its revenues to the artists signed up to it. It's been a long time coming. How is it looking, Chris?
It has been a very long time coming. So, yes, you're right. This originally began as part of Mega Upload before Mega Upload was shut down by the US authorities in 2012. Originally, it was called Megabox, which was a terrible name. I quite like Baboom. I think Baboom's quite a good name. I'm not sure it sort of communicates a serious sort of helping artists monetize their work, but it's much better than Megabox anyway.
Well, neither does Bandcamp.
No. Or musically.
to be fair.
So this has been part of Kim.com's plan for a long time. Obviously, in 2012, his main business, Mega Upload, the file transfer business and video sharing service, was shut down by the US authorities. The criminal case against .com and his other Mega Upload chiefs continue. They're trying to extradite those people to the US to charge them with copyright infringement and money laundering and racketeering. But despite having to fight off those extradition attempts, Kim.com has done very well at pursuing other business interests in the last 3 years. Obviously, he set up a new file transfer service called Mega, and then he set up Baboom, the direct-to-fan service, although .com himself has since stood down from both of those businesses. So he's no longer anything to do with Mega, and he's no longer anything to do with Baboom either.
His split from Mega seems quite acrimonious, but in the case of Baboom, he sold his 45% stake in the company last October, and said that he was doing so because he was holding it back because the music industry hates him, and he felt that the service would do much better without him on board. And now it's launched, so that's like one step further.
Although, as we will find out later on in this podcast, just because the music industry hates Kim.com doesn't necessarily mean that they're not willing to do business with him. But we'll come back to that, because you're right, he is now nothing to do with Baboom, but it has gone live. And of course, it sort of went in a sort of beta form live last year, didn't it, with Kim.com's own album. If you remember, .com tried to be a pop star, he released an album, and to sort of demo what Baboom would be doing, he put up his album very early last year. The implication being that this now is Baboom in beta and that it'll be rolling out for use by other artists very soon, but it's taken another 18 months. And I have a feeling that a lot about what Baboom does has actually changed in those 18 months.
Yes, I mean, I remember meeting Mikey Tucker from Baboom, I think around about that time, actually, in kind of January, February last year. And him talking about how kind of the business model was changing and they were just ironing out the creases and that was what was delaying it again. And it has, but it has, I mean, it has an interesting business model, levels of business model.
It does. And what's interesting is the streaming element. So, I mean, for starters, when .com first started talking about what was their mega box, and at one point he claimed that the reason why the major record companies have been so keen to see mega uploads shut down is because they were so terrified about the potential impact of mega box to basically render all record companies redundant, that's why they had it in for him. Even though there have been other direct-to-fan platforms, we've already name-checked some of them, for years now, none of which have made record companies redundant, and indeed, arguably, these direct-to-fan channels, record companies are getting involved in running them. So rather than competing with labels, they're just another tool, another part of the business for labels to get involved in. So the concept of a direct-to-fan platform is not new, and some of the elements of Baboom selling downloads direct-to-fans, selling tickets direct-to-fans, I mean, there's loads of services that do that, and we've mentioned Bandcamp and Musicglue are probably the big two, certainly for artists in the UK. But it is the streaming element of Baboom that is interesting, in that artists are being encouraged to put their content into the system, to offer that as download to their fans, but also then to move that content into a Baboom streaming catalogue, and then subscribing users can access that music in much the same way that they access music on other streaming services too.
Yeah, and for, I mean, it was always talked up as a service that would give away music for free. There is a freemium option, but actually the freemium's fairly restricted, far more restricted than I think we would have expected originally.
Yeah, compared to, say, Spotify, what the free version on Baboom gets you is A, access to 100 songs at any one time, which is something that some other services, do you remember, Bloom were sort of playing with. So out of the entire catalogue of music available on Baboom, or there's also a digital locker element to this, so users can upload their own MP3 collection, and at any one time they'll be able to access 100 tracks through their devices, through their PC, through their phone, over the Baboom system, but that is all on freemium. Also, Baboom are allowing, and indeed seemingly encouraging, artists to keep some of their content back for premium users only. So it's interesting, given the ongoing debate about Spotify freemium and Deezer freemium, and are we giving too much away for free, that Baboom, as you know, given that Kim.com back in the day was a big advocate of giving away content and finding other ways of making money, have actually come to the market with a freemium service that is probably more in line with what many of the major labels want Spotify and Deezer to ultimately morph into.
I mean, it's interesting how the money is divided up as well. There's a $10 a month subscription, as with many services. But however, unlike, I would say, most other streaming services, certainly Spotify and the like, the money that a user puts into the service through their subscription is divided up amongst only the artists that they listen to, rather than being put into a central pot and divided up between, you know, everyone on the service.
Yeah, that is interesting. And I suppose partly that's because ultimately Baboom is not a streaming service, it's a direct-to-fan platform. So I suppose it makes sense that, you know, the money that fans put in should be going to the artists with whom they're having a direct relationship. But I think it's more interesting than that, because the way in which money gets divvied up on all streaming services has come up for debate in recent months. Obviously, there have been all sorts of debates around streaming royalties over the last few years. Are the streaming services paying enough? What's happening to the money once it reaches the labels? But there is this other debate that has been ongoing in recent months, which is the way Spotify and most of its competitors work is that all the money that comes in any one month is put in a pot, and then the money is divvied up between artists and rights owners based on how much their music was used across the platform. So you had 0.01% of all consumption across the platform, or if you're a big major record company, you had 32% of all consumption across the platform over any one month, and so therefore you're due 32% of the money, and here's your money. Whereas some people are now saying, but if a user happens to pay £10 for a month and only listen to one artist, then that artist should get all of the £10, obviously minus all of the commissions that different people take, even though that means they're probably getting more per stream than another artist over here. And it's something that's come up at a number of sort of music conferences I've been to recently, is this would this not be a more fair way of structuring it? Although you sense that pop artists and major record companies would lose out on that system. So they're unlikely to encourage or even allow Spotify or Deezer to move in that direction. But that is basically the system that Baboom have opted for with their service. So the sell to users being, the assumption being that if you're on a direct-to-fan platform, you care about artists, whereas I'm not sure more mainstream consumers really do care whether or not the artists are actually getting the money. But the idea is on a direct-to-fan platform, you do care that the artists are earning from your consumption. And so in theory, under this system, if you listen to someone's music, you know that they're getting, you know, more of your money. It's not just that they're getting whatever the minuscule sum of money would be once it's divvied up across the system. I'm not sure I've explained that very well, but just know that it's a different way of calculating the royalties, and some people would say that it's more artist friendly, certainly more grassroots artist friendly.
Well, I think typically, I mean, I know at least one person who doesn't subscribe to Spotify or anything like that. When we discussed it, he specifically mentioned Spotify because he doesn't want to fund major label artists. But you can't choose where your money goes. If you sign up to Spotify, your money goes in, as you say, your money goes into a pot. Whereas this is, you know, with this, with Baboom, the money that you put into the service is only going to go to the artists you listen to. So if you put in your $10 and you only listen to one artist, that artist will get $9 minus a transaction fee.
Yeah, minus any of the admin fees and et cetera, et cetera. So it is interesting. And I think a challenge for Baboom, well, there's many challenges for Baboom. Firstly, just that the direct-to-fan market is already quite competitive. You know, lots of artists are on Bandcamp, lots of artists are on Music Glue. And once you've gone to all that effort to build a store around one platform, why would you either just leap to a new platform and do it all again? Or I don't think many artists want to have to run two direct-to-fan platforms, two stores on two different competing websites. So they're entering a crowded marketplace. And when it comes to the streaming bit, they're not going into the streaming market as a Spotify competitor. They're not signing up massive catalogues of content from big rights owners. They're relying on lots of grassroots artists to put their content in there. The problem with that is that you will inevitably end up with predominantly music from unsigned artists and independent artists, which makes it more of a niche service. Which makes that digital locker bit, I think, very important here. Because I suppose what Baboom are saying to their users is, come onto our platform and go around our community and get all these grassroots, new, interesting, quirky, independent artists. But you can also bring in some of your MP3 collections so that when you open the Baboom app on your phone, you don't just have to listen to the new unsigned independent music that we have, you can bring in some of your major label content too. What I don't know is how that digital locker bit is licensed, because some digital locker companies say we don't need a license for a digital locker because the customers have already bought the MP3s. Under copyright law, they're allowed to make private copies, as we discussed last week. In the UK, technically they're not, but they're allowed to make private copies of those MP3s, and so we don't need a separate license. The major labels generally disagree, and iTunes Locker and the Amazon Locker and the Google Locker are licensed. But the digital locker bit, I think, is crucial for this service to have any, you know, potential of gaining a sizable user base.
Yes, so it's a question still remain about whether it can take off. Although I do think it is an interesting service that could gain some ground if they get the promotion right, if they attract the right artists to experiment with it. I suppose you only need a few artists to experiment with it a bit and say, oh, actually, I'm making decent money off this, and then word gets round. I mean, Bandcamp is probably the big player that they're fighting against here, and Bandcamp has spent a long time building up its user base. It's certainly not something that's grown overnight, and I think that's probably the biggest hurdle is the amount of time it will take to really build up a strong catalogue of artists uploading their content to this. They'll have to be self-releasing artists and independent artists signed to independent labels. I mean, they said they're trying to attract independent labels as well. But it's getting the right people on board to make it an attractive proposition.
But in the meantime, whether or not it succeeds long-term or not, it is interesting seeing them sort of dabble with different ways of doing streaming. Because, I mean, although most streaming services are basically offering the same service at the moment, they're either of the Pandora model or they're of the Spotify model, and they're basically the same service, same content, same price point, there are, you know, it's by no means assured that the Spotify business model is the business model, either True. From a consumer-facing point of view or behind the scenes in terms of how the royalties are divvied up. And it is interesting to see Baboom enter the market, doing things a little bit different on freemium and doing things differently on the way royalties are split up. And it'll be a test of whether or not those things work.
Yeah. And as we've discussed before, you know, they're kind of very much going for the limited catalogue in terms of, you know, if people have got their own kind of MP3 collection loaded into this locker and then of loading in. I mean, I don't know whether that's like the kind of the people who have a small MP3 collection of major label artists then want to listen to some unsigned acts they've never heard of. Whether they're going for quite the right demographic or what, you know, whether they're accidentally splitting their demographics, I don't know. But it's going for that limited collection rather than the kind of all you can eat, here's 30 million tracks, isn't that brilliant kind of idea. Which is something we've discussed, I think we've discussed certainly in CMU, if not on the podcast before, is something that the streaming market requires. It's different types of services, not lots of different services offering the same thing and like jumping over themselves to offer more and more content.
Interestingly, when we've talked about the need to be services that offer sort of less content on a cheaper price point or in a different way,
I suppose it's not on a cheaper price point, is it?
No. And also, when we've talked about that in the past, we've generally referred to it as being aimed at a more mainstream consumer, so at a sort of, you know, a capital FM listener. Whereas, as you say, the issue here is that because they're going for the unsigned band, direct to fan, independent artist thing, actually there may be creating a service that would work for a really mainstream consumer, but they won't have the content that the really mainstream consumer wants.
Yeah. Well, that's the point I was trying to make, is that they've got a service that seems like it might be attractive to a mainstream consumer, but with content that's definitely not going to be what they want because it's not mainstream. So it'll be something to watch, and I think it'd be interesting. I mean, it's always interesting when someone new comes in with something interesting, doing something slightly different. So we'll keep an eye on it and see how it goes.
And can I just say again, I love the name Baboom, and I love saying it. So well done, Baboom, for picking your name. Don't know if that was Kim.com, but I like it.
Now, people listening to the intro may have spotted that this is quite a Kim.com heavy edition of the CMU podcast, because we're now going to talk about Mega Upload, which is obviously the service that spawned Baboom and also made Kim.com the infamous man he is today. This relates to the data held on the services of Mega Upload. As you said previously in the last story, Mega Upload was forced offline by US authorities in January 2012, so 3.5 years ago now. And yet there's still some data from their servers held basically on computers stored in a warehouse in the US. Virginia, I think it is. But the company doing that hosting would like that not to be the case anymore.
Yeah, so when Mega Upload was taken offline, at that point, Kim.com's company didn't actually own its own servers. It leased servers from a number of different companies around the world.
This is partly why it was easy to take offline, because they could just go for the server companies.
And most attention was put on Carpathia Hosting, I think that's how you say the name of this company, which was one of the US hosting companies that .com was using, although I think there was one in Canada, there was certainly one in Europe as well.
Yeah, in Holland, the Netherlands.
Basically, when the American authorities raided these servers, they just disconnected them from the internet and then let them sit there gathering dust, all still in situ. Now, the reason why Mega Upload was taken offline is because an awful lot of the content that users were uploading to the Mega Upload servers was copyright infringing music files and movie files and TV shows. And then people were then sharing that content, and there were sort of forums out there where people could go and get the links. And, you know, obviously the accusation is that .com was deliberately running a copyright infringing company and encouraging users to infringe copyright. These are the allegations that if he ever gets to court in America will be tested. But that was the accusations against him. So a lot of the content sitting on these servers in the US and in Europe and elsewhere was copyright infringing content anyway, so nobody cared that people had lost access to that content overnight, because it probably shouldn't have been there to start with. Having said that, Mega Upload was just a file transfer company. In essence, it was almost like a Dropbox competitor, wasn't it? Or a RapidShare competitor. And plenty of people were using it as a legitimate file storage system, that they were putting their own documents or videos or photos up onto Mega Upload for safe storage or to share with other people. And they too, overnight, that I think it was a Friday in 2012, suddenly that was all turned off and they couldn't access their files, which, as you can imagine, for those people was a bit annoying to suddenly have no access to your files.
Yes, and I mean, some of those people went legal and tried to get their files back unsuccessfully. There was talk of trying to find ways to allow people to get their files back. The problem is, the only way you could really do that would be simply to turn Mega Upload back on, which would give everyone access to their files again, so legal and illegal. And that's why the US authorities never really went for that idea.
Yeah, and when those few people did go legal, and there was one guy in particular who went legal, who was a sports journalist who had a load of video content that he lost access to, and he was supported by the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And when it went to court, the judge actually was very sympathetic in saying, yeah, this guy should get his content back. What can we do? And as you say, various proposals were put forward. Kim.com proposed that he buy the servers off the companies who'd hosted them, and that he would then, I don't know, hire a team of people to go through them to separate the infringing content from the non-infringing content. The problem with that was that Top.com doesn't have any money.
Well, and there's just so much content on those servers. You can't, and you can't just go in and access people's accounts. I did speak to someone from a server company about this, and he was like, yeah, the only way I could see it of working would be to just turn it back on.
And even if there was some system, it would be expensive, and you know, by this point Mega Upload had been shut down, all of its assets had been seized. So Kim.com's lawyers were saying, well, if you give us back some of that money you've seized, we will spend it on finding a solution. But then the US authorities and the movie industry and the music industry said, well, hang on a second, we think that money was gained through illegal business, and you know, the labels and the movie studios are suing .com and Mega Upload and hoping to get that in damages. So despite the judge saying we should get this guy his files back, it never happened, and the US authorities were not very helpful at all. So you know, the American government basically said, well, the terms and conditions on Mega Upload clearly stated that you should keep a backup of your files, so if you didn't keep a backup of your files offline and you lost them, well, that's your fault. But it's sort of the whole point, really, isn't it, of cloud storage, is that you don't have to keep copies offline at home. So it doesn't seem like a very helpful response from the US government.
No, but I mean, so that data has been slowly, I mean, as you expect, over the course of 3 years, has been disappearing. In 2013, the Dutch firm Leaseweb wiped 630 machines full of Mega Upload content. But the company that we're talking about, Carpathia, which held, I think, the largest collection of Mega Upload data, has 1,103 servers worth of information that was given a protection order in March 2012 to stop it being wiped because the FBI, etc., wanted access to it as evidence. And so that's still sitting there in a warehouse somewhere, waiting for that to happen.
Originally, it was literally sitting there, still all plugged in, and they could have just flicked a switch and it all would have gone back online. I think since then, because it was very expensive to have it set up like that, they've taken the servers out of the facility and they are now just stacked up in a warehouse. So the just switch it back on option is no longer there. It would be a lot of work to get those servers back in a way that we could be reconnect them to the internet. And then they're just sitting there gathering dust, and Carpathia Hosting is having to pay to rent a warehouse in which to store these damn things.
So yeah, when those servers were all still kind of sitting there as was, just doing nothing, Carpathia was saying that, you know, it was costing them $9,000 a day just to have them there waiting for the day someone might want to come and look at them. Since they have moved them all to a smaller warehouse, that cost has come down, but it's still $6,000 a month, which, you know, isn't nothing. Which I think, and now Carpathia has also been taken over by a new company, QTS, and it's that company that wants this protection order to be lifted so that they can wipe the servers and put them back into use now.
Yeah, so new owners are not so happy with the idea of having to spend $6,000 a month just to keep these servers in a shed, on the off chance that either the American government or you know, legal reps for the record companies or the movie studios will come to get evidence off them, let alone reconnecting it somehow so users can get their content back. And one of the things they said was, you know, nobody has been to look at these servers since 2012. So they're just sitting there. Clearly nobody's interested in them. can we not just wipe them and then we can get these servers back into racks and start using them again and start making some money? So that's what Carpathia Hosting have been asking for. The judge is now considering that request. Kim.com and his legal people continue to say, do not delete the data. A, we think there's useful evidence there for us when we're if the court case in America ever kicks off and we have to defend ourselves. Plus, he still seems hopeful, I don't think this could happen, that he might be able to reconnect his former customers with their content.
Yeah, that did seem to be him. And in his legal filing, it did say, we want to give people back their data, but also we think there's evidence useful to our case on there. Because their argument would obviously be that, Mega Upload was a legitimate service being used by some of its users for illegitimate means. But the fact that people were storing their sports videos on there that they owned, shows that it wasn't an exclusively piracy-focused service.
So we'll see how the judge responds to that. Before we move on to the next story, you said there's been a lot of Kim.com news this week, and there is one other little quick Kim.com story that we ought to mention, which goes back to what I was alluding to in the first story on the podcast today, which is a moment not long before the 2012 raid, when Mega Upload was shut down, when Universal Music, who in theory hated Mega Upload and hated .com, it turns out, actually I'm not sure this is that big a surprise, but it turns out that they were talking to .com about collaborating on one of his many, many, many startup ventures.
Yeah, and one of his more controversial startup ventures too. What was it called? MegaKey, which was a service that never launched, but the idea was that you would sign up for this service and you could get free downloads of music, and it would make money by replacing adverts on websites that you visited. So basically, going onto a website where they had an advert placed and to raise money for that website, and then hijacking it, essentially, which I don't think was ever going to go down very well.
Yeah, so what's happened this week is Kim.com, for reasons best known to himself, I'm not sure anyone has explained why he did this week, put onto SoundCloud a recording of a phone conference he had with some digital people, some quite senior digital people at Universal just before the Mega Upload raid and shutdown, in which he was pitching this service to them, and they seemed quite interested. And when somebody said, this is going to be pretty controversial, they said, well, perhaps if we just sort of started slowly drip feeding the adverts so that we wouldn't take over all the adverts on another web page, we'd just take over about 10% of the banner ad spots in total. And then someone else said, well, let's just do Google ads. Let's just take over any, because most websites have some Google advertising on the site. Let's just try and knock out the Google advertising, and Mega can sell the advertising instead, and they'll be much more generous in how much money they pay to the record companies. And then basically there was a bit of a conversation where they're saying, because Google, they're bastards anyway, they've all made all this money on the back of your content, the music industry's content, and they don't share that money with you. So if we screw over Google, so be it, because they're Google. I mean, I'm paraphrasing slightly, but that is basically the conversation that was had.
But not that much.
So, as I say, this conversation took place 3 years ago, just before the Mega Upload shutdown. There is a little bit of talk about the fact that Universal and Mega Upload are in conflict, and actually what dates the conversation is they talk about the Mega Song dispute. Remember the Mega Song dispute?
Yes, I do. Let's move on.
That preceded the Mega Upload
shutdown. Not getting that in my head again.
So, and they mentioned the Mega Song dispute, which is, I think, what does date this conversation to being not long before the Mega Upload shutdown. So, I don't know why. Why did .com release it? Was it to embarrass Universal? I don't see how it helps his legal case. If anything, it makes it worse for his legal case, because I would imagine he wasn't meant to be recording the conversation, certainly wasn't meant to be publishing the conversation. So I imagine that there was potentially a legal argument under the laws of confidence or whatever is similar in America that he really shouldn't have done that. And you could say...
Presumably he has been sitting on this recording waiting to use it as evidence in his... one of the cases against him, and maybe, I don't know, maybe he's just got bored of waiting.
Or perhaps it just serviced recently. Perhaps he didn't have it the whole 3 years and he suddenly found it. I don't know. Don't know why he's put it out there. But I suppose from Universal's side, they could say, well, what this shows is, you think we, as big record companies, once we've decided we don't like somebody, we then shut our ears to any good ideas. Because quite often, piracy services, even though they're infringing copyright and ultimately they may well be a bad thing for the music community. But often, amongst all of that, they do have some good ideas. And I suppose what Universal could say is this showed that, you know, this guy had a good idea or potentially a good idea. And just because we had a dispute over here with him didn't stop us listening to his pitch over here. And as for the Google bashing, it's a bit embarrassing. But I mean, it's no secret that major record companies, despite being in business with Google and, you know, and Universal through Vivo, is literally in business with Google. They're both shareholders in Vivo. Yet at the same time, it's no secret that the record industry has problems with a lot of what Google does. So I'm not sure there's any major revelations in that conversation. Don't know why he published it. Not sure whether we should recommend you go and listen to it, but it was interesting. Let's just say it was interesting.
You should definitely go and listen to it.
Go and find it on SoundCloud then.
Okay, returning to a story we've discussed quite a lot in recent podcasts, I think, as Robert Silliman's buyback plan for SFX Entertainment. How's that going?
Not very well. Although you could say, perhaps in a weird, perverse sort of way, perhaps it is going sort of well. So as we discussed before, I'm pretty sure, because remember that the whole Beatport thing got caught up in all of this. Robert Silliman, veteran entertainment industry mogul, set up the new SFX a few years ago, started buying up all those EDM festivals, bought Beatport, bought various other sort of EDM-based businesses, floated it in 2013 to raise a lot of money on the NASDAQ stock exchange, and then decided at the start of this year he didn't like being in charge of a publicly listed company where, you know, analysts on Wall Street question your every decision, and decided he wanted to take it back into private ownership. There was then a bit of a wrangling because most of the, I mean, he owns about a third of the business, just under. The other shareholders weren't very impressed with this idea that he was suddenly going to take it back into private ownership. He eventually convinced the board of the company and the independent directors on the board to a $5.25 bid. So he said, I'm going to buy all the shares I don't currently own. I'll pay $5.25. That was a pretty good offer because at that point, the shares in SFX were worth $3.70. So he was paying quite a premium. And then he went off to try and raise the money to go through with that transaction. It then became apparent that he probably wasn't going to raise that money. And SFX set a deadline of last week to prove that he had the finance in place for the $5.25 transaction. And lo and behold, he didn't. Not least because of all the insecurity that this buyback plan has instigated, and then the whole Beatport thing we talked about the other week just made people panic even more, the share price in SFX on NASDAQ has been, you know, it's just plummeting.
Yeah, getting towards a dollar now, which is considerably less than $5.25.
Yeah, as we record this, not just a few cents above a dollar per share, which made $5.25, A, incredibly generous, and B, utterly unrealistic that he was ever going to get people to finance that buyback. So it became quite clear by, well, the beginning of last week that it wasn't going to happen. Silliman admitted on Thursday last week that he was never going to raise that amount of money. And so on Friday, what SFX said is, okay, that plan is now officially off. We're going to take a step back and we're basically now going to consider any offers for our business. So if anybody else wants to buy SFX or part of SFX, because when they took other possible bids a month or 6 weeks ago, when Silliman was first putting together his 525 offer, they did allow other people to come forward, and nobody else was interested in buying SFX outright, although there was some interest in buying some of the assets. And so what SFX have sort of intimated now is that they are now up to considering those kinds of offers. They've set the 2nd of October as a deadline. But in the meantime, Silliman is off trying to come up with a new package, and he will presumably at some point in the next 6 weeks come back and say, okay, not $5.25 a share now that they're a dollar a share, but some other offer that hopefully he will be able to get backing for. So as far as Silliman is concerned, this is just a temporary setback, and he will return with another offer to try and take SFX back into private ownership.
Yes, and he's got to hope that SFX doesn't get a better offer for bits of the business, because I assume he wants the whole thing, and having bits of it sold off to other people. I mean, I suppose you could get into a situation where he ends up buying part of it, although I don't know, that would be a situation I'd assume he would have to be cornered into rather than something he would put on the table up front.
Certainly everything he's said to date is that, you know, he wants the business that he has built to stay as it is and to move that forward and to grow it, but to do so in private ownership rather than under the sort of constant scrutiny of being listed on the Nasdaq Stock Exchange. And the reason why I said in some ways it's not going very well, but you could perhaps say, but is it sort of going well, is that because the share price has plummeted in the last 6 months, and especially in the last month, he could now come back with, I don't know, a $2 a share offer, which on the current share price would still be a decent deal for current shareholders, and get to buy back his company at a fraction of what he was originally offering for it a few months ago. So in a really perverse sort of way, although it you know, you don't want your business to be surrounded by all of this insecurity, and it could backfire, and it could be that, you know, the really big lucrative festivals get sold off to a Live Nation or an AEG or something. It could be that Silliman gets what he wanted, but won't have to pay anywhere near as much money as it looked like he was going to earlier in the year. So perhaps it will all work out good for Silliman. So good job that Beatport turned around and said, actually, we are going to start paying labels, because they were saying, weren't they, that we can't pay labels their money until this buyback thing is sorted.
Yeah.
This buyback thing now could run and run. So it's a good job that turned out to be nonsense, and Beatport are, as far as we're aware, paying their labels.
So still no end to this story. It's looking like it's one that's going to run and run, but that's fine because it's quite good fun. We're enjoying it, at least. And it's probably something we'll revisit on the podcast for your enjoyment too. Okay, quickly time to look through some of the other stories that have been featuring in music industry news over the last week. And returning to a story we discussed at length in the podcast last week, the MPAA has withdrawn its Weblock lawsuit, which we talked about big tech opposing last week. But it's not because of that letter that they've done it. It's because the site they wanted to take down is already down. So MovieTube has been down for several weeks. So, you know, why block it if it's already gone? That's basically the thrust of it.
So this was Hollywood's attempt to get MovieTube sued out of business, but B, also to force internet service providers in America, and search engines for that matter, to stop people from accessing the site. As we discussed at length last week, web blocking is not currently something that has been possible under American law, so it was potentially a test case. It will now not be a test case because the MPAA has withdrawn the crucial web blocking bit of this litigation. And although, as you say, they insist it's nothing to do with that letter that Big Tech wrote, they did then say in their submission where they updated their lawsuit, but you should now ignore that letter because it's clearly now redundant. So, so there is clearly a bit of a link.
Something probably pretty predictable now. SoundCloud has announced it's no longer going to provide data to Next Big Sound because Pandora bought it back in May. And as with the Echo Nest being bought by Spotify, other companies suddenly decide that they don't want to deal with those companies anymore.
It's a challenge, isn't it, that all sort of interesting, buzzy music data startups who take in data from digital services and from labels and then represent that in an interesting way to the industry or to digital services who want to use that data to build sort of interesting curation services, all those buzzy startups ultimately end up being bought by one DSP. And then all the other DSPs are like, well, we don't want to work with you anymore, as is now happening with Next Big Sound. So that means there is now a gap in the market for another music data service, because they've all now been bought, except that presumably that one too will then just get bought by, I don't know, by Google or something, and the whole process will continue again. But so it'll be interesting to see if we see any new music data independent companies launching on the market to try and sort of take these gaps in the market.
A US research firm said that 48% of people who signed up to Apple Music are no longer actually using the service, though Apple insists that 79% are using it.
Yeah, this research was based on a survey of 5,000 US consumers. So it's not somebody has got sort of, you know, sneaky access to Apple's user stats. It was just based on a bit of market research. And they said of the people we surveyed, half of the people who had signed up to Apple Music pretty much now aren't using it. Apple insists that that is not the wider trend, and nearly 80% are continuing to use it. Although obviously what we're still really waiting for is the end of September, when those people have to stop paying for it, and will they continue to use it? So, but it was interesting to see those stats doing the rounds. And that 48% of people no longer using it got picked up by a lot of media. So Apple were very keen to sort of set the record straight.
Yes, I mean, it also said that over 60% of people had turned off the auto update subscription, so they wouldn't be paying for it come October. But we'll see. I mean, a survey of 5,000 people is not a survey of all of them, all of the Apple Music users.
And it was just America. So, you know, America. It might be a trend in the US, but not over here. Who knows?
Sticking with Apple Music, the iTunes Festival is dead. This year, we'll see the Apple Music Festival launched for the first time, featuring performances from One Direction, Pharrell Williams and Florence and the Machine up at the Roundhouse in Camden, and others.
Yes. So once again, Apple choosing London to stage this mini festival and to pull loads of exclusive content. But now it's not just that exclusive content will be made available for the boring, dull, old-fashioned iTunes store. It will now have Beats One exclusives, and you'll be able to connect to the artists through Apple Music Connect. And I'm sure it will all be incredibly exciting. Who can wait for the Apple Music Festival 2015? I know I can't.
No, me neither. Deezer is reportedly raising new funding with a $1 billion euro valuation. Bloomberg sources say that an IPO may be considered.
Which is the interesting bit of this story. So the fact that Deezer need to raise more money is not surprising. All streaming services need to raise more money. It's expensive running a loss-leading streaming service. Spotify obviously closed a new round of funding quite recently. But one thing that is quite interesting here is, yeah, Bloomberg sources saying that an IPO is not definitely happening, but it is not, has not been ruled out, which is interesting because I don't think any of us expected Deezer to be going to a flotation route to raise money this soon. I think most of us assumed that Spotify would float before Deezer would float. So if they were to go the IPO route, what does that tell us about Deezer's ability to raise money through private sort of venture capitalists and such like? And also, it would be a really interesting test for the big streaming music flotation, which will presumably happen at some point in the next couple of years, which is the Spotify IPO.
The UK government has said that a pilot scheme whereby UK major labels get age ratings from the BBFC for videos before posting them on YouTube and Vevo is to be made permanent. And independent labels have been encouraged to participate. And YouTube and Vevo encouraged to do more with the info.
Nothing to add to that, really, except that you remain convinced that this is a pointless initiative because it doesn't include videos that come out of America, and that's where all the controversial videos come from.
Yeah, that is the problem. In the obviously, it's, you know, it's the BBFC giving the ratings. It's only music videos created in the UK, so there's a lot of music created outside the UK, and not least, like, if you think of all the big controversial videos of the last few years, they've all pretty much exclusively been US artists, and these artists are not getting age ratings. So, as you know, as much as they talk up this scheme being a success that's working well, I mean, they also did have to say, let's hope that, you know, other countries follow suit on this.
So who knows? Perhaps those Nicki Minaj videos will be amongst those that will eventually get rated. That's me doing a segue into the final of our We Didn't Cover It stories.
Yes, I noticed, because Madame Tussauds in Las Vegas is putting extra security around its Nicki Minaj waxwork, which is based on a pose from her Anaconda video, because people are standing next to it doing suggestive poses alongside it.
And then sticking those photos on Instagram, they're going viral, and that's not the publicity Madame Tussauds apparently is looking for.
Who could have guessed that would happen?
So they're going to have people standing next to the Nicki Minaj waxwork saying, yes, she may be on all fours in a very suggestive position, but that's no reason to be taking naughty photos. So
come on, everyone, there's nothing to see here. Move along.
So it'll be interesting to see whether or not that works. We should move on to the final story, not least because I am once again doing this podcast from the 3 weeks podcast suite in Edinburgh, aka...
Do you mean cupboard?
A cupboard in the middle of the flat. I was thinking about doing this edition from the actual room where I work, but then just as we were about to start recording, this brass band started playing outside my window, which happens when you're at the Edinburgh Fringe. And actually, this brass band have been playing every single day at around about the same time. And they're a pretty good brass band, although they do play exactly the same stream of music every single day. And I thought that will seep through and it will come in the background. We don't have a PRS license for this podcast. We can't have music coming in at the background.
No.
Although I have just said that it's quite good, so that would account as critical analysis. So we could probably have the music seeping in on the critical analysis copyright exception. So we probably wouldn't be infringing copyright. But because of that, I thought, no, I'll go back into that little cupboard, which is pretty soundproofed. It may be echoey again. If it is, I apologise. But let's all agree that it's better than when I was doing it on my mobile phone 2 weeks ago. But it's getting very hot in here. Do you remember how it used to be when we used to do the podcast in the olden days in that tiny little meeting room in our sort of Shoreditch High Street office? And by the end, it was like being in a sauna and we were sort of dripping in sweat and it was a really horrible experience. Well, it's getting a bit like that now here. So let's talk about the bloody voice and Tom Jones and be done with it.
We can do that, or we could just, now that I know you're in extreme discomfort, I might just drag this last bit out for a while.
Well, if I go silent, you'll know I've passed out.
You've done anything else this week? Any other brass bands? Do you know what? My sister-in-law used to have a guy stand outside her window every day playing the Birdie song on the saxophone. So I think you're at least better off than that.
It is true. They only play for about half an hour each day. And although they play exactly the same music every day, they have yet to play the Birdie song. So, okay, I should. And I quite like brass bands. Normally, I quite enjoy it.
They can't go on The Voice, though.
They can't go on The Voice.
They can't go on The Voice.
Because they are brass instruments.
Because that's just about voices. We will talk about The Voice now. Because
they could go on Britain's Got Talent. But yeah, get on with
The
Voice.
Yeah, this is about
story.
The Voice. Because there's
assuming they're British. They might not be British. But anyway, get on with The Voice story.
We can talk about Britain's Got Talent if you want.
I don't want to talk about Britain's Got Talent.
Well, I don't want to talk about The Voice, but we're going to, because the new judges...
Say, it's amazing how many shows here at the Edinburgh Fringe are putting the fact that they've been on .. Ghost Talent on their posters, and they've got their little remarks at Simon Cowell. Since when has that been a reason to go and see a show at the largest arts festival in
that
the world?
That would not attract me.
Sorry, that's a little fringe moan there. Let's talk about The Bloody Voice.
I don't know. Shall we?
Well... You know that I didn't really want to talk about this story at all. It was you who insisted that we should have a sort of And Finally story this week like normal. So you talk about it. What happened with The Voice, Andy?
Well, the new judges have been announced on The Voice, and they are Boy George and Paloma Faith, which is
I bet
exciting,
you're very
isn't
excited
it?
About.
Though it's very exciting.
Because I know you're a big fan of The Voice, Boy George and Paloma Faith, so this is a triple whammy for you.
But the quick-minded amongst you will have noted that there was only one space for a new judge on The Voice because it was only Rita Ora who left. The other three remained. So that means one of them is gone. Who is it?
After Series 4, will.i.am, Ricky Wilson and Tom Jones all indicated that they would be returning for another series. So there isn't room for five people. They couldn't possibly... I mean, the BBC's having to keep costs under control. There's no way they could afford a fifth one of those stupid chairs. So clearly someone was for the axe here. And you only had to read about two-thirds of the way down the press release announcing these new judges to start to see everybody saying how great Tom Jones is. And so clearly that was them saying, Tom Jones is really great, because we've sacked him. He's no longer on the show, and that's why we're bigging him up and saying how lovely he is. This was news to us, it was news to you, but most importantly of all, it was canon news to Tom Jones.
Yes, Tom Jones put a statement out on his Facebook page saying that he'd been given 24 hours notice that this announcement was going out, telling the world that he'd been dropped from the judging panel. And he was not happy about it. He said he'd already put the time in his schedule to be involved in this series, and it was a big surprise to him to be axed. He's always supported the show, and then with no consultation or conversation of any kind, he was told he wouldn't be returning this year. He did say he was quite happy to support creative change within the show, and he'd seen a lot of that over the 4 years he'd been involved, but he thought this was substandard behaviour from the BBC and found it very disappointing.
Yeah, what he was saying was it wasn't that he was angry that he was being dropped and that he recognised that shows need to be reinvented and revamped, and he sort of said, you know, over his career he's had lots of relaunches, he didn't have a problem with that. What he has a problem with is the fact that he was only given 24 hours notice that this was happening. In their response, the BBC said, well, we only made up our mind 24 hours ago, and this is how it's been every year, and as soon as we've made up our mind, we put out a press announcement because otherwise it would leak. And my God, imagine if it leaked and people knew who the new voice judges were before they'd officially announced it. So that was why we did it, said the BBC. But I sort of wish I watched The Voice, because then I could boycott it on Tom Jones's behalf. But I don't, so I don't know.
I think you can still boycott it. Currently, you're just not watching it. But you could actively boycott it. I think you can do both of those things.
And perhaps, like every other consumer in the United Kingdom, I could continue to boycott buying any records by any finalist on the show. So yes. So let's all officially, rather than just not participating in The Voice in 2016, let's actively boycott it. As we stick up for Mr. Tom Jones, or Sir Tom Jones, as some people like to call him, the Queen mainly. But I've said that Tom Jones did wrap up his speech in saying, I can't remember his exact words, but basically saying, I wish them all well, didn't he? So he wasn't calling for a boycott. He was just wanting it to be on record that he felt he'd been treated a bit shabby.
Now, we're assuming that it was Boy George who took Tom Jones's place on the judging panel, not Paloma Faith, because she obviously was taking up the token woman position. Boy George is taking the elder statesman chair, would that be fair to say? In his taking of that chair, it was obviously necessary for him to make some sort of comment on this, and he did so. He said on Twitter, I have absolute respect for Tom Jones. The man is an absolute legend. Huge fan.
So that's all right then. That's all that settled.
Yeah.
What were we all moaning about? I don't even know why we spent the last 5 minutes of this podcast even talking about this story. Clearly, the whole matter has been addressed.
That was the friendly treatment that Tom Jones was looking for all along. And now he's got it from Boy George on Twitter.
Once again, Boy George has saved the day. And there you go. That's such a common ending of the CMU podcast, that Boy George steps in the last minute and sorts everything out. So I
assume that's what's going to happen in the SFX story as well.
Yeah, we'll come back to that when Boy George sorts it out. So that might be next week, it might be the week after, we're not sure, but that's almost certainly will be the resolution. Anyway, it has now reached almost volcanic temperatures in my little cupboard / 3 weeks podcast suite. So why don't you do that stuff that you do at the end of the podcast, and then we'll call it a day.
Yeah, all right. Well, it is the end of the podcast. If you want to find out what Boy George is going to be saving next week, Do hit the subscribe button to receive this podcast automatically, and then you'll know, and your life will be fulfilled. It will be great. You could also, rate, review and share if you wanted. Just for, like, you know this. I say this every week. Do all that stuff. It'll be fun for everyone. Honestly, you'll make friends. This CMU podcast, as all of them, was presented by me, Andy Malt, and live from Edinburgh, not live, but he's in Edinburgh, is Chris Cook. It was produced by Matt Peaty down here in London with me. And for more information on CMU, you can visit completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
The only problem is, by having two new judges, well, have you died?
No, I knocked something.